Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
We are here with a group of firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and their families to talk about firstresponders.com, the website devoted to the financial life of first responders. Excuse me, what's your name? Okay, Jim, tell me, what do you like best about firstresponders.com? Is it the credit card that tells everybody you're a first responder, or their competitive mortgage rates? Oh, it's the Responder Rewards Program. Exclusive discounts you and your family get from hundreds of retail outlets, from home improvement to electronics to clothing. Up to 40% off. Great. Is this your little doggy? Hey, buddy. Everybody seems to love the benefits of firstresponders.com. Right, everybody?
You speak your own language, we speak it too. That's because firstresponders.com was created by first responders. With benefits like great mortgage products, discounts at retailers, and the first responders credit card, it's not just a credit card, it's a badge. Firstresponders.com, giving back to the people who give.
Welcome to Through the Smoke. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. This week we've got an outstanding show. Actually, it was recorded back in July at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, and our guest is going to be Chief Sal Cassano of the New York City Fire Department. He is the chief of department. We'll be back to that in just a second. I want to also mention that our upcoming Through the Smoke, not the one you're listening to right now, but the next broadcast is going to be basically a recording of a panel that we had. The show's based upon a panel we had at the International Association of Fire Chiefs, Fire Rescue International in Atlanta. We're going to use that information for a show. My guests on that panel and the guests for the show will be retired FDNY Chief of Department, Chief Pete Hayden, Commissioner Lloyd Ayers from the City of Philadelphia, Chief Jerry Dio from Worcester, Chief Charlie Dickinson, retired Fire Chief of Pittsburgh, and the current Deputy United States Fire Administrator, Chief Stan Gibson from Coos Bay, Oregon, and Deputy Chief Colleen Walls from the Pittsburgh Fire Department. Again, they're going to be sharing with us insight on multiple firefighter line-of-duty deaths that have occurred at specific single incidents. So don't miss the show. That'll be probably posted in the next, probably in the next 2 weeks. This week's guest, again, is Chief Sal Cassano. I'm going to get to him in a minute. But first, a couple of comments on a couple of hot issues that are going on. Number one, our hearts go out to the Greek Fire Service and the loss of three firefighters over this past weekend at those appears to be arson set wildland fires that are going on out there. The report came out, the final report came out on the city of Baltimore and the line of duty death of fire recruit Rachel Wilson, and the numerous investigations have come out, but this most recent one concluded that they violated 50 national safety standards. The instructor set too many fires inside the row house, failed to have water available. They found that Wilson had been sent to the burning building with an inexperienced instructor who didn't have a radio. She was wearing old protective pants with holes frayed in them. She was ordered to climb above the fire before putting them out without any hose lines, and ultimately she became trapped in the third floor window. Wilson's family and friends called the findings criminal. The mayor of Baltimore, who so far has been strongly behind the fire chief, Sheila Dixon, said in a written statement last week that she had reviewed the report and she is now deeply troubled by the circumstances that led to recruit Wilson's tragic death. The mayor said that while certain changes have been made, she fired the head of the training academy and two other fire commanders, more are needed. So we're anxious to see what changes are going to be made, but more importantly, what we can learn from this. I mean, problems started at this fire, this training fire, well before that day, with doubts about whether the department should have allowed Wilson to enter the class. She failed a physical agility test by a narrow margin, and she could not hold a charge hose line without falling down. Part of the City Fire Academy requires recruits to battle real-life conditions, as it should. The investigative report noted that it typically takes 60 days to plan a live burn, But they rushed through the process, and that really, you know, added to the problem. I mean, we can go on and on and on. I mean, when recruits and instructors arrived that day, they hauled dozens of wooden pallets and 11 bales of Excelsior, thin wood shavings, into the building. Two fires went through the house with flares lighting these fires on the second and third floor, violating the standard. And the standard is there, and I guess that's kind of where I'm going with this. NFPA 1403 works. It works, it has worked, and it's done fine for years. It was developed after firefighters died during training burns. So then why wouldn't we be following 1403? It's got, you know, they call what happened there criminal. Well, it is criminal. How would you feel if it was your daughter, your son, your wife, your husband who was inside that training, and those responsible took such an aloof look and such a careless attitude toward the safety of your loved one or your brother or sister firefighters? We got to think about this. Don't even think about doing any training without following the standard. It just makes good sense. Additionally, obviously what's in the news, too, is the tragic fire that occurred at the Deutsche Bank building a week ago in New York City. You know, they found so many issues wrong, and now we're only a week into this, but there's too many. You don't have enough fingers to point at who may be responsible for this terrible situation. The standpipe that was supposed to be used was broken and hadn't been inspected. Those overseeing the site didn't care, obviously, about fire protection. Some are saying the fire department had no plan to fight fires in the building, but from my listening to the dispatch tapes, the dispatchers did provide the responding companies with information, and one of the first arriving companies stated they had reports of workers perhaps trapped on the scaffolding. So there was a life safety issue that nobody seems to be talking much about, which may have forced firefighters to have to go in and find out. The building, owned by an agency that's run by the governor and the mayor, is still standing. There just don't seem to be enough fingers to point at all the politicians, the state and federal agencies, and even the city agencies that have oversight in this horrible Deutsche Bank building that burned last week that killed two firefighters. Subcontractors have been removed for their job from safety violations, but there were tons of violations. This isn't new. A New York City newspaper called for the fire commissioner's resignation, but I'm not sure the fire commissioner's responsible. Maybe he is. Maybe he's the bottom line and he has to go and someone has to come in and overtake the organization working with the uniform force at FDNY. But who knows? I mean, this is amazing. Everybody looks bad in this. It looks like the government at the state and federal and even local level screwed up pretty badly, and no one wants to take the blame. I can tell you, the incident commander, Chief Galvin, is one of the most stand-up chiefs on the job, and if you ever have an opportunity to meet him, work with him, or talk with him, you'll understand what I mean. He was thrust into the situation, as were these firefighters, with obviously hidden agendas by perhaps politicians and perhaps even crooked contractors who were involved in trying to get this building torn down and trying to make as much money as it could as possible. You know, it's 3 years ago that the government put themselves in charge of this skyscraper, which was badly damaged on September 11th when the South Tower collapsed and fell into it. The building was gashed open and toxic debris seeped in, and this one sued that one sued this one. And then the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, a rebuilding agency with authority from the governor and the mayor, bought the tower, and they chose private contractors to clean it up and take it down. The first contractors either backed out or replaced after their plans didn't satisfy environmental regulators, or they raised their prices. And then when they discovered bones of September 11th victims throughout the building, that caused more controversy and had to slow down the tower's removal, as it should. Those are remains of people. The governor of New York referred to the delays a day after that fire, saying it's a tragedy that wouldn't have occurred if they got the building torn down as they should have. But on the other hand, when you find victims' remains in there, that takes on a different flavor. You know, none of this really matters, except the fact that some firefighters died in the line of duty, and now it really matters. There was a standpipe that wasn't operating properly. The sprinkler system was shut down. And when arriving on the scene, FDNY's companies, though, were advised that there were people trapped or possibly workers on the floors above. I personally heard the radio traffic, so I know that happened. And firefighters Robert Padilla and firefighter Joseph Graffanino died because of this mess. So So we're going to find out and see what happens and who's responsible. His family is left with this, or rather both their families are left with this horrible mess, realizing now that their loved ones died for what appears to be a skyscraping dumpster, a high-rise dumpster. It's a building filled with crap. The workers, if they were in there, there should have been a safe means of getting them down. If fire protection systems were in place, if the sprinkler system was maintained, if standpipes existed, and if the owners of the building took a fire safety approach, the chances of those firefighters dying would have been a lot less. So we'll wait and see what happens with that situation. Obviously, it's one that concerns all of us. In the meantime, if you and your city have buildings under demolition, what's the plan? What if you have a fire? What's the standpipe system look like? Is the sprinkler system still in service? These are the questions that we have to learn from. We can start learning right now as we move forward and find out the facts based upon whoever does the investigation to find out what happened in New York City. And one more story I want to talk to you about is Waterbury, Connecticut. An attorney for Waterbury, Connecticut firefighter Joe Fischetti has filed paperwork with plans to sue the city for injuries he received in a fatal fire apparatus versus fire apparatus crash. As you remember, two apparatus collided with each other going to a fire call. The claim laid out by his attorney is at odds with the accident investigation report released last week by the cops. That report found that Fischetti ran a red light at the intersection in violation of state law and fire department SOPs. But Fischetti's claim is that William Mahoney, the driver of the other apparatus, was at fault. They wrote in their claim, "Truck 1 operated by William Mahoney was traveling too fast for the conditions, failed to slow or stop at the intersection to ensure he was clear before proceeding." Well, that makes sense to us. If you have a red light, you stop, period. How many times are we going to learn about these crashes? However, firefighter Fischetti was ejected from the engine in the collision that killed Captain John Keane, and he suffered fractures to both hips, ribs, neck, and back, as well as traumatic brain injury. Investigators determined that firefighter Fischetti and Captain Keane were not wearing seatbelts, and that was the primary reason for the seriousness of their injuries. So if we stop at red lights, we stop at stop signs, we put our seatbelts on, I'd have nothing to talk about right now. Well, you know, the interview that I did and the interview I had the opportunity to do with Chief Cassano was outstanding, and you're going to hear it in just a minute. And I really enjoyed talking with the chief. I've had the opportunity to get to know him over the years. But when you listen to the interview, you're going to see he is as genuine as he can be. He is truly a firefighter's firefighter. His love and caring attitude toward his organization, his members, his officers, just shines when he speaks to you. Clearly, the events of last week in the Deutsche Bank building struck deep in the heart of Chief Cassano, as it has in every member of the FDNY and every member of the fire service. But as we've seen Chief Cassano in the past take leadership and take problems by the horn and move forward to solve the problems, I have no doubt he'll be playing that same role here as well. Chief Cassano was appointed as an FDNY firefighter in November of 1969, and he worked several years at engine companies in Lower Manhattan. He was promoted to lieutenant in 77 and worked at Ladder 113 in Brooklyn, where he also served in his promotion to captain in 1984. He continued to rise through the ranks as a battalion chief in 1987, deputy chief in 1993, deputy assistant chief in 1999, and assistant chief in 2001, working in various assignments throughout the city, including responsibility as the on-duty citywide fire tour commander. He's been cited over 5 times for bravery during his career. Chief Cassano, as you'll hear, was at the World Trade Center following September 11th. Chief Cassano was named Chief of Operations, succeeding Chief Dan Nigro, who was appointed Chief of Department following the line-of-duty death of Chief Pete Gansey. As Chief of Operations, Chief Cassano held the second-highest uniform rank in the FDNY, managing daily fire and EMS operations for the department's 11,500 firefighters and nearly 3,000 EMS personnel. In his role as Chief of Department, he oversees 3 major uniform bureaus, operations, training, and fire prevention. Chief Cassano has a bachelor's degree in fire science from John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he and his wife Teresa reside in Staten Island, and they have 5 kids. All right, well, sit back, listen to the broadcast and the interview with Chief Cassano. I know you're going to enjoy it. And again, listen up again, if not next week, the week after. We're going to have posted the other interview that we did, or the panel we did, at Fire Rescue International in Atlanta, which is the show hosted by the International Association of Fire Chiefs, where we'll be talking about multiple firefighter line of duty deaths at specific fires. Be sure to tune in. Thanks for listening.
We are here with a group of firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and their families to talk about firstresponders.com, the website devoted to the financial life of first responders. Excuse me, what's your name? Okay, Jim, tell me, what do you like best about firstresponders.com? Is it the credit card that tells everybody you're a first responder, or their competitive mortgage rates? Oh, it's the Responder Rewards Program. Exclusive discounts you and your family get from hundreds of retail outlets, from home improvement to electronics to clothing. Up to 40% off. Great. Is this your little doggy? Hey, buddy. Everybody seems to love the benefits of firstresponders.com. Right, everybody?
You speak your own language, we speak it too. That's because firstresponders.com was created by first responders. With benefits like great mortgage products, discounts at retailers, and the first responders credit card, it's not just a credit card, it's a badge. Firstresponders.com, giving back to the people who give.
Welcome to Through the Smoke. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder, the host of Through the Smoke. Got an outstanding guest with us today. We are recording this show live here at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore. The chief of the best and biggest fire department in the world, Chief Sal Cassano from FDNY. Welcome, Chief.
Thanks, Billy. My pleasure.
It's great to hear you. First of all, it's great to see you at the show. Yourself, Chief Orozco, and several other chiefs of the biggest departments in our country are right here walking the hallways with other firefighters and spending time. And it really gives people a chance to see your regular fireman, who worked his way up, and now you're the regular fireman in charge of the biggest department in the country.
We all started as probies and worked our way up, and our job is to make sure everybody goes home safe.
That's a challenge these days, for sure. What about your history, Chief? When did you get on the job? Tell our listeners a little about yourself.
I started in the department in November of 1969, and naturally, family business. My brother was a lieutenant on the job, and just staying with him and his friends, I realized that it was an unbelievable job. It was more vocation than a job. I knew I never was going to get rich, and I certainly am never not rich, but I knew that the job was going to provide a lot of self-satisfaction, and that's worth more than the money that you could get in other jobs. So I started in November 69. I got promoted to lieutenant. I worked in Lower Manhattan as a firefighter. Spent 7 years as a firefighter in Lower Manhattan. Got promoted to lieutenant in 1977. Went to work in Brooklyn. Spent 7 years in Brooklyn in a busy truck company, Ladder 113.
Pretty good fire duty back then.
Great fire duty, very self-satisfying.
Went Look home, at the smile.
Went home tired at night, but that was great. And then I got promoted to captain in 1984. Lo and behold, I ended up back in the same truck company. Probably was the first time anybody had gone back to a company where they were a lieutenant. And it was great to be back as the captain of Ladder 113 in Brooklyn. Got promoted to battalion chief in 1987 and bounced around the city for a couple of years. Ended up in a battalion 4-0 in Sunset Park in Brooklyn and stayed there for another 6 years. Great time. Great job, battalion chief. Very rewarding. And then I got promoted to deputy chief in 1993. Bounced around the city for a while, and I ended up working in Manhattan in the 1st Division in Lower Manhattan.
Now, for our listeners, Chief, a deputy chief in New York City oversees numerous battalion chiefs. Is it the same as a division?
Yeah, it's a division. Well, you oversee a division, and usually there's anywhere between 5 and 7 battalions, and each battalion has 6 or 7, up to 10 companies.
Okay.
So you got a lot of responsibilities as a division chief, deputy chief. And I spent a couple of years in Lower Manhattan, went out to Staten Island for a short stint. I live in Staten Island, so it was nice to see what was going on in the borough I live. And then I was, in 1997, they made me the division commander of Brooklyn, the 15th Division, which was the busiest division in the city at that time.
So and at that point, you were overseeing numerous deputy chiefs.
Yep, I was overseeing.
Division commander, is that a deputy assistant chief?
No, I was just a regular deputy chief. Not a regular deputy chief, but I was a deputy chief, but in charge of the whole division.
Okay, I see.
And they sort of elevated the position at that time in 1997.
Okay.
And then I spent a year and a half in Brooklyn. And then they asked me if I would take over the 1st Division of Manhattan as a division commander. Very prestigious position. You're overseeing all of the operations from the Lower Manhattan, the Battery, all the way up to 42nd Street.
Those are the chiefs that have to wear their ties.
Exactly. I guess they wanted to take me out of some of the rougher area, polished me up a little bit, right. Sent me to Manhattan to learn. And I can remember speaking to Commissioner Feehan, may he rest in peace. He was killed on September 11th. He was a very good friend of mine. He was like a mentor to me. And we had a very serious fire on Atlantic Avenue in the June of 98. And we were in the hospital at that time. And he says to me, Sal, I want to send you to Manhattan. I said, I love it here. Why do you want to send me to Manhattan? I was already there. He says, we want to groom you. We want to train you. We see you rising through the ranks, possibly someday being a chief of operations. And we need to get you into Manhattan just to see how it goes in Manhattan. And that was in 1998, never dreaming what would happen 3 years later.
Right.
So I went to Manhattan as the division commander. And in 1999, they promoted me to deputy assistant chief. Now, that oversees a bunch of different divisions.
Okay.
And I got a position which they call a citywide tour commander, so that each day we had a different citywide tour commander. We would oversee all the operations in the city for 24 hours.
So the highest ranking on-duty chief.
Exactly.
Basically.
Once okay. the chief of operations, chief of department left headquarters, I was taken command. And I oversaw Manhattan as my role. And then, naturally, I got promoted on 2001, September 12th, to the chief of operations after the terrible tragedy. Great responsibility, but I had great people working for me. We were in a recovery process, a rebuilding process. I was proud to say that I was part of rebuilding the fire department, along with a lot of other good people.
Sure.
So for almost 5 years, I was the chief of operations. And then on June 17th, 2006, I was lucky enough to be promoted to the chief of department, the greatest fire department in the world. And
wow.
I've been the chief of department ever since.
That's some little story, I guess you could tell about 1,000 stories in between each sentence of
we'd be here till next year.
Where you have the line. Chief, I want to later on talk to you about certain line of duty deaths that you were close to over the years. We'll do that later in the show, but let's talk for a few minutes about September 11th, your story, so to speak. Where were you and your perspective, and share that with our readers,
sure.
Listeners, if you would.
On the morning of September 11th, I was in headquarters with Pete Gansey, chief of department, who was lost on that day. Chief Danny Nigro was the chief of operations. We had Donald Burns, who we lost that day, and Jerry Barber, another my closest friend on the department that we lost that day. We were all in the command center just having coffee, just figuring out what had happened the day before, what we were planning on doing that day. And over the radio, we hear a blurt over the radio, explosion at the World Trade Center, possibly a propane explosion. Didn't know what it was, it was instantaneously. And naturally with that, we knew that it was going to be a difficult operation. And the chief of department, chief of operations, took off to go down to the scene. I went out to the chief of department's office, Pete's office, to look out the window and saw this tremendous amount of smoke in the North Tower, and realized that by that time we knew a plane had hit the North Tower. And I looked at my XO and said, this can't be an accident.
XO,
no way.
Your executive officer.
Yeah, my executive officer.
Right.
And I realized, says, Mike, this can't be an accident. Take a look. It's beautiful. It's clear. The sky is unbelievably bright. No plane could hit that building by accident. So I got in my car, took a couple of EMTs that were at the site. As I was leaving the building, there were a number of people that didn't want to come down. And I said, look, stay here. We have enough people down. We have enough help. I need more people here in headquarters. So just don't go yet. Got down to the scene, parked my car on West Broadway in Lower Manhattan, right adjacent to the North Tower, just to see if I could get a better view. And with that, the second plane hit the South Tower. I thought it was a secondary explosion at the time because
right.
I couldn't see the South Tower. And looked up and realized that this was going to be an unbelievable day in the history of the New York City Fire Department. I made my way around to the command on West Street, right off of Vesey, right in front of the North Tower. And we had our field comms set up on the median of the West Street. I looked up and
field
I looked
communications
field communications
yeah.
unit. They were set up on West Street. And I looked up at the building. I looked up at where we were. And I says, we're too close. We're too close to where the things are going on. I says, get as close to the building, as far across the street as you can. Sit up close to the building in case something starts flying off the building.
Sure.
We had people jumping. We had windows breaking. And then Chief Gansey, Pete, came to the command center on West Street, and we worked together. I worked actually for him. He says, look, stay with me. He sent me into the Marriott. to find out what units we had in the Marriott Hotel. So I took a rundown of the list in the Marriott. I met up with some great people in the Marriott that never made it out that day. On West Street, when I came back, I met Father Michael Judge. We talked a little bit about the events of the day. He looked at me, I looked at him. I knew it wasn't going to be a good day. I actually said, Father, we're going to need a lot of help here. Get some more chaplains. We just knew it was going to be a dark day. Made my way back to the command post, and that's when the South Tower collapsed. Luckily, we scurried into a garage in the World Financial Center. Myself, Pete, whoever else was at the command post, Commissioner Feen was at the command post at the time. And a few minutes later, we were able to regroup. And then we looked up and just couldn't believe what happened.
Sure.
Never expected it, but knew that we had the people in the North Tower. We had to get people out of the North Tower. Pete Gansey, chief of department, told me, Sal, get everybody up north. I need to get people up north. But Pete wouldn't go north.
Right.
If anybody knew Pete, they know
that's
why he didn't go north.
Right.
He told Ray Downey, get me five truck companies. Let's go down. We got to get some rescues going. Pete went south. I went to the corner of West and Vesey, where I met up with Chief Hayden, who was the incident commander in the lobby of the North Tower. Told me the orders were to move everybody up north, up to Chamber Street, get the command post moving north. We did that. Met the chief of safety, Al Turi, told him what we had. And we had to get everybody at the North Tower, and then we were moving everybody up towards Chamber Street. Once I gave those orders that Pete told me to give, I started to walk south because I was going to work with Pete for the rest of the day. That's what I wanted to do. Pete's a good guy to follow, a good guy to work with. And I started to walk down south to meet up with Pete. And all of a sudden, I heard this rumbling and this roar, and I thought there was another plane overhead. And I looked up, and it was the North Tower that was collapsing. So I turned around and started to see if I could get out of the way of this crumbling building.
Sure.
I started to run north and looked up, and I didn't realize I was going to get any further. So I dove under one of our rescue rigs. It was Rescue 3's collapse rig at the scene, and dove under the rig and survived the storm. And
there but for the grace of God.
There but for the grace of God. Another few feet south, another few feet east, I wouldn't have made it. I was very lucky. Somebody was looking out for me. So I survived the collapse. I had gotten banged up. Again, lo and behold, there's a bunch of EMTs as I crawl out from under this apparatus with a stretcher and a backboard. And they put me on a backboard, and I was probably one of the first ones removed to the hospital. I went up to St. Vinny's. There was plenty of doctors and nurses waiting, but nobody was coming.
Right.
You either survived or you didn't. So they quickly put me through x-rays and whatever, and I was fine, just banged up.
But your mind must have been all over the place.
There was a lot of things going on.
My goodness, yeah.
Without a doubt. So I told them to take me back to headquarters because I knew nobody was in headquarters. And then I went back to headquarters and I worked out of our operations center for the next couple of days.
Yeah, right.
And just putting things together, helping putting things together.
I've only gotten to know you personally over the last 2 years. I didn't really know you well back then. But like most of us, watched you, and you've been able to keep a positive attitude. You've always got that smile, like the head coach.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of a dumb question, but how are you doing it? I mean, part of it, we're all made differently. Everybody's different, and we have different ways of dealing with things. But you really are. I mean, and Pete Hayden, who's a good friend too. The come on, we got to keep going. I guess there was no other option, right?
There was no other option. You know, I had a lot of people. After September 11th, told me we have to change procedures. What are we going to do? We have a young workforce. We have inexperience. I said, well, we have two choices. We can pack our bags and go home, and then we don't have a fire department, or we can make do what we have and figure out how we're going to rebuild.
Well, take advantage of all these young people.
Got a lot of young people, great camaraderie. They're excellent condition, smart, dedicated, enthusiastic. I said, that'll make up for a lot of inexperience.
Sure.
And I remember having a conversation with my wife one night, probably a couple of months after September 11th, trying to think of why in the heck did I survive? And so many of my good friends working side by side that day didn't.
Survivor's guilt kind of a thing, right?
To some extent. Yeah. And she looked at me and said, well, did you ever think that there was a job that you had to do? And maybe the good Lord spared you for a reason?
Yeah.
And I says, wow.
That's powerful stuff.
Powerful stuff. It put me in the right perspective to say, well, you know what? Let's go ahead, move ahead. And I won't take no for an answer. I mean, you know, it's almost 6 years, and I think today, July 27th, 2007, we have more firefighters, we have more training, more equipment, and maybe a little less experience than we were on September 11, 2001. And I think that's a testament to the members of this department, not only me.
Sure.
Members that have come through this department that have since retired, that took on this yeoman task of how we're going to rebuild a department that lost 343 of its members, its chief of department, its first deputy fire commissioner, 21 high-ranking chiefs, 25% of our special operations command. How are we going to rebuild? And we did. We had a lot of good people. We have somebody here today that's one of your instructors, John Norman, who was instrumental in helping rebuild this department.
Yes.
Now, John recently retired, but I still call him for advice. Yeah. He's a great friend. He's a great person to reach out to. He's got a great composure about him, and he's one of the most knowledgeable members of the fire service community, not in the United States, throughout the world.
Sure, we've been having
so John that's how we did it
for years. Yeah.
So it's me to orchestrate it, but I had a great cast,
coaching staff.
Yeah.
Good coaching staff.
Yeah.
You're the first appointed chief of department. That's kind of interesting, and what that means is you serve at the pleasure of the fire commissioner. So you don't have that civil service protection as chief of department. You're still protected as a member of the organization, I would assume, right? I mean, you could pick another spot if you
Sure,
wanted
I could go back to being a deputy chief if I wanted. I have my civil service title.
Yeah.
It's funny. I was promoted off the list. The list hadn't been expired yet, so I was promoted off the list as a civil service title.
Okay.
And then somewhere midstream,
you went out for a cup of coffee.
I said the union actually negotiated with the city, and the city's been trying to get this for a long time to say we want to be able to appoint the chief of the department. So somewhere along my first 3 or 4 months, the change was made, the title was changed, and I became from a civil servant to an appointed position.
Right.
And to be very honest with you, I like the idea, because as a civil servant, they were only allowing the chief of the department to serve a year or 2 years possible, no matter what kind of a job you did.
Yep.
Even if you did a great job, you know, Chief Hayden left, who did a great job for us.
Yeah.
He had now Commissioner Crothers, chief of department at the time, left because of this tenure issue. The city wasn't going to give us tenure. So while I'm only appointed, I think I wouldn't want to stay if they didn't think I was doing a good job, whether I was a civil servant or not.
You probably have more opportunity for success this
way. I have opportunity for success because now dealing with the mayor on a very first-hand basis and the commissioner daily, there's no reason unless I'm not doing my job.
The barrier isn't there.
Exactly.
Either. Yeah.
So I have a lot to say about what goes on in the department, what goes on in the city for fire protection, and a lot of other things.
You're listening to Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. We're talking with Sal Cassano, chief of department, FDNY. A reminder, this show is brought to you by First Responder Financial, Dennis Smith's First Responder Financial, and his vice president, Pete Hayden, who we've been talking about as well.
Both good friends of mine.
Both and good people. And look, we wouldn't be here today at Firehouse if it weren't for Dennis Smith coming up with this idea many, many moons ago. I was going to ask you generally what's going on at FDNY, but let's jump to something else since we're talking about the rebuilding of the organization following 9/11. Let's talk about probie school. You've certainly had a lot of probies, big numbers of probies, and I know over the last couple years your challenges in dealing with a probie school now is to create more, create firefighters with more ability to feel like they have more experience by training them right, because fires are down anyway, you know, pretty much everywhere, and so we need to make up that experience. You lost guys to retirement, lost guys in the line of duty, and probie school's changed a lot. So talk about that. I'm fascinated by the fact that you've extended probie school quite a bit. I love that, and I love the reason.
So do I. I love it. I'll give you a mind-boggling number. In the last almost 6 years, we've hired over 5,000 probies.
Unbelievable.
That's a number that probably nobody could fathom. And to train them, and to train them to the level where they need to be to operate in the city of New York, is just sometimes you say, wow, how can you do it? And a couple ways we do it. We have a great chief of training, Tom Galvin, who was preceded by a couple of other good chief of trainings. We have dedicated staff that are out there. And now we have the support of the commissioner and the mayor We've extended our probie school 10 weeks. The new class starting on August 6th is going to be a 23-week training program.
So it was 13 weeks.
When it was 13, the last class was 18, and now it's going to be 23 weeks. 23 intensive weeks of training.
It's half a year.
Yeah, intensive. It's a long day.
What are some of the components, Chief?
I think the biggest change, well, we all have all hands-on training. You got your rope, your ladders, your tools, your fitting. You get your EMS component. But there's a lot of classroom work that goes into this.
Because FDNY is running first responder, too.
Yeah.
And for the listeners that aren't aware of that, FDNY's engine companies, primarily engine companies, they handle
all our engine companies do our CFRD work.
Okay, yeah. Doing the EMS first responder on critical calls. Yep, so they're absolutely. Doing EMS. So those who don't like EMS, wherever you go these days, that's the job.
Absolutely.
And honestly, you have much more of a chance to save a life when you're doing an EMS than the opportunity to fire. But anyway, go ahead, Chief. Talk about
that's
the,
that's a good point, Bill. We get a lot of pushback sometimes on our EMS and medical work. But the New York City Fire Department right now is doing about 43% of our runs are medical calls. Mind-boggling.
Fire division, not talking about the EMS division.
No, I'm just talking about fire ops.
Engine and truck companies,
And truck companies, we're doing almost 43% of our runs are EMS work. And that's just as important as anything else we go out to do. If you save a life in a fire, you save somebody else on a critical call, cardiac, a life saved is a life saved.
Sure.
It doesn't matter how you save them.
Sure.
So, you know, I know that somewhere out in this fire service field, this EMS work isn't totally embraced, but I can tell you from the chief of the largest fire department in the world, medical runs are the future, and we're going to have to embrace that.
Well, we've talked about that.
We're going to have to embrace it.
Yep.
So some of the key components now in probie school, a couple of our recent fire deaths had to do with some faulty construction.
So you're talking about line of duty deaths.
Line of duty deaths.
Right.
We had a collapse last August 27th in the Bronx, some faulty construction. So we decided that we need to teach probies all the way up the line to chief officers building construction. We are giving them a building construction component in probie school, along with the fire inspection component. So what we're teaching our probies now is how to fight a fire in each type of occupancy, whether it be a taxpayer, whether it be a tenement, whether it be a private dwelling, whether it be high-rise. How is the building constructed? How would you inspect that building, and how would you fight that fire? So we're giving them total component of each building, which we've never done before.
Know the enemy, like Frank Brannigan.
Exactly.
So you're giving them
know
all
your
all.
Enemy.
Yeah.
Frank
yeah.
was way ahead of his time.
Sure.
Know what you're going to go into before you go into it. So that's one component that we are teaching
Frank
that we haven't
Brannigan,
done before.
One of the three founding members of the Bell Club.
There you go.
FDNY
that's
Bell
right.
Club.
Who now I'm an honorary member as the chief
there
of department at our dinner in
now
June.
Now you're allowed at those
now
secret
Now I'm allowed
meetings.
At those secret meetings. And for the people out there that are a member of the Bell Club, it's something that I hold near and dear to my heart because they keep the tradition of the fire service alive.
Yeah.
And that's something that we should never forget.
A lot of new blood coming in the Bell Club, too. I'm a long-time member of the Bell Club, and a lot of the guys on the job are joining the Bell Club. I was anxious to see that.
There's a lot of people that have set the bar for us that are in the fire service now in the last 50 to 100 years, and we must never forget what they've done for us.
Yeah, that's right. Anyways, I interrupt you, but
that's okay.
It's good stuff.
So that's one big component. Naturally, we have our... hazmat training now that we've had to step up because of the recent events. We have terrorism awareness training, a lot of classroom work. We are also teaching them fire safety education. How do you go out and communicate to the public how it is to be safe from a fire? We save more lives through fire prevention and fire safety education than we will ever save at fires.
That's so important. What you just said is a big deal. You know, we assume the firefighter can go and talk to the public. But a lot of firefighters are shy. They don't want to do that. They're uncomfortable with that. So you're teaching them those communication skills,
exactly.
things to say. And that's great.
Exactly.
That's
again, people that don't think it's... We're a business-oriented service now. We are customer-oriented. The public is our customers. We have to get the message of how to prevent fires. Every fire you prevent is less firefighter injuries, less civilian injuries, less property damage, more money to the city coffers. We have to think like that because all of that affects your department. Whether it's New York, Chicago, Boston, L.A., any place, how you prevent fires is going to go a long way towards the way your department operates. So we realize that we're going to teach them communication skills, we're going to teach them written skills, things that we never thought were very important a few years ago. Now we realize being a customer-oriented service, how important that is.
You're going to hone those skills.
Without a doubt. And also, there's a lot of things that are going on. Now, when you extend a probie school 23 weeks, you still have to keep their hands-on skills fresh. So you can't teach them in the first 13 weeks and forget about it.
Right.
So every day they get hands-on training. Every day they get physical fitness training. You know, they come into the academy thinking they're in shape. They're not anywhere near in shape. when we get them out of the academy, they're in shape, because you couldn't pass if you didn't. So
right, right.
They come in thinking they're in shape. They go out in much, much better shape. And so it's a job that you have to be physically fit. We lose more firefighters throughout the country to heart attacks and cardiac vascular disease than any other
50%
combined.
50%.
50%.
Yeah, 50%.
So if we can get them into that mindset of staying in shape, then they're going to be safe throughout their career.
Yeah.
I try to run every day. I run every day. I try to lead by example. They know I'm. I believe in physical fitness. I believe in diet. I believe in fitness, wellness. And if I can do it, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but if I can do it, certainly those probies and everybody coming up the line can do it.
We really have to. You know, if we love, if we love being firefighters so much, then why wouldn't we do the things we need to do so we can continue being firefighters? I used to hover around 300 pounds for a long time, and it's tough. And you know, I don't know if you ever had a weight problem.
Yeah, sure.
But you get older, you get one, no matter whether you want one or not. And to keep where I'm at, and it's a constant struggle, but it's worth it. I want to keep going to fires. I want to be around for my family and
absolutely
stuff like that. So, you know, that's what we do. We don't think it's going to happen to us, and then one day, boom. So, you know.
And we lead by example.
And setting the example as a boss.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, that's neat about what's going on at probie school. Now, probie school happens at The Rock, which is the New York City Fire Academy on Randall's Island. And physically, you've made some incredible changes. It's a fire college. It's a university. I mean, you even the entrance. I was there for an RHS meeting a few weeks ago, and it's like walking into a university. The attitude, the flavor, the environment is fantastic. What's up? Can you highlight some
sure
of those changes?
We're very proud of our fire academy. We feel like we're one of the elite fire departments in the world, one of. And I think that we needed a training academy that would be indicative of that ranking. So our new training academy was put together in the last administration, but we are still building on it every day. We have you've been there, Billy. We have this whole mock-up city with different types of buildings. We have a taxpayer. We have a tenement building. We are adding a high-rise simulator. It's almost a $5 million project.
Wow.
Which we're going to do groundbreaking on, hopefully, in the next few months.
Can you describe that?
Sure. It's a building that's going to be mocking a high-rise building. It's next to our ladder building right now.
Sure.
So each floor will be a different type. We're going to have a multiple-dwelling high-rise floor. We're going to have a commercial high-rise floor open area. We're going to have access stairs that you would have in a high-rise building. We're going to have command panels. We're going to have panels in the first floor. Anything that you would encounter in any, whether it's a residential high-rise building or a commercial building, high-rise building is going to be in our simulator.
Wow.
A lot of money was donated to us by different organizations. We're very excited about it because, thank God, we don't go to many high-rise fires. But when you do, they're one of your toughest fires that you got to fight.
Sure.
So we're going to try to continue to train our people in high-rise firefighting. But now having a building, we can do it at our own academy. It's terrific. That's one of our
really
components.
Really give the people involved the feeling of being on that 30th floor.
Absolutely.
With the 30th, wind and all the other issues.
All of that stuff.
Yeah.
Simulators are going to be in there. So, you know, the high-rise simulator is coming up. But we also have driving simulators out there now. We just put a flashover simulator about a year ago. Again, you mentioned, say, fires are down. Fires are down, but, you know, you go to one fire, that's all you need
that's
to go.
That's right.
To.
One or 1,000.
It doesn't
gotta
matter. You've got to have the same skills whether you go to one or you go to 10
that's
a day.
That's right.
In fact, it's probably more important if you go to one a day to have the skills than going to 10.
Because at 10, you'd be a little bit more useful.
Exactly.
Sure.
So we have a flashover simulator out there now that we're putting all our people through. It's a great, great program. We have a smoke house. We have so many other things that ensure training. But what people miss out there is, while we have all our ladders, we do all our hands-on training, I think the heart and soul of the academy is a lot of our classroom work. People overlook our classroom work in that, you know, again, it's not a blue-collar job anymore. You have to be really, really smart. You have to know the chemistry of fire. You have to know the chemistry of hazmat materials. You have to have your communication skills to deal with the public and the people. There's so many things that you have to have in a classroom that people think it's a blue-collar job. It's not. You need a college education. To be a firefighter, you need college-level education.
Absolutely.
It's that important.
Yep.
That you have to be that smart. And I keep pushing college education,
yeah,
and I think it's a future to fire service.
Well, you used the word future twice in our discussions, EMS and education. And I talk to young firefighters, and I tell them, I don't care what you see on TV. I don't care what the old days were. I don't care about backdraft, rescue me, or any of that stuff. Listen to me. You'll be going to those calls, too. But if you're not thinking about paramedic school, if you're not thinking about a degree, then you're probably not going to be successful in the very near future, if not today's fire service.
They're selling themselves and their department and the service short if they don't think that
way. Exactly. We're talking to Chief of Department Sal Cassano from FDNY. We'll be right back. This is Through the Smoke Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder, brought to you by First Responder Financial.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back. This is Through the Smoke Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. And again, we're sponsored by and appreciate First Responder Financial. Dennis Smith and Pete Hayden over at First Responder Financial. I strongly suggest you click the link below, check out the services they're offering to firefighters and other first responders. If you're going to get a credit card, if you need a home loan and things like that, why wouldn't you want to deal with a firefighter, someone with a long reputation of serving us and a person who's been very successful in his life, and he can share that with you as well. So check out First Responder Financial. We're back with Chief of Department Sal Cassano. Chief, it's a pleasure to have you talking with us. I know that there'll be a lot of listeners to this show, just this view from the outside into FDNY. What's going on at FDNY? A broad range question that you can just pick a subject and tell us what's new. What's your favorite stuff?
Anything about the department is my favorite stuff. So,
and I said during the break, you can tell someone who loves what they do by the look on their face, and this is a radio, so you have a face for radio, this, right? But you're really you're glowing, and you're talking about your kids, your family.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
the same look you get when you talk about your loved ones, and of course, you've got between fire and EMS. How many kids do you have?
Almost 14,500.
So you've got your hands full, and then as the man in charge, you have a lot of responsibility. So what's going on?
Well, in the last 5.5 years, you know, with our rebuilding of the department after September 11th, which was our darkest day, but our brightest day also, because it showed the public and the world what firefighters do, not only in New York, but throughout the country and the world. And as you know, it's a very close-knit group, whether you're a firefighter in New York or Chicago or Boston or Detroit. You know, we come from the same cloth. They call us type A personalities, but that's what it takes to get the job done. But in New York, we're very excited. When there are so many different things that we are doing, I'll just give you some of our terrorism preparedness issues. We started with a tier response. You know, after September 11th, we realized that we had to expand and decentralize. So we trained many different units. We have 25 truck companies that are there to support our rescue and our squads. We call them SOC support trucks. They've been given 80 additional hours of training. So now they have meters. They carry all different types of equipment. And they are decentralized throughout the city, so that if another major event hits, we don't have to pull our resources from one area.
So you kind of felt like you had all your eggs in one basket.
We did.
We did.
Yeah, we did. Okay. And we realized early on that we have to do business in a different way. So we've trained 25 truck companies. We have 25 decon engines out there. We have 35 hashtag ambulances. We've trained our ambulances into hazardous materials. So we have this whole tiered response where we start at a lower level, and all our companies are trained to the operations level. And so you'll have a first responder operations level. If the incident ratchets up, we have our hazmat technician units, which are our squads, and one of our rescues, and we have four engines trained. And then if it really gets ramped up, we have our hazmat one unit, which we have specialists on there, the most highly trained, probably hazmat people in the country.
Sure.
They have hundreds of hours of training. And naturally, so that's what we call our tiered response. And it's a good response plan so that you're not sending all your top-level people all the time.
Right.
It works very well. So we've done that. I think one of the initiatives that you're going to see coming out in the near future is some of the intelligence work that we've been doing with Homeland Security. The fire service for many, many years has been shut out of the information and intelligence sharing. It's just been viewed as a law enforcement initiative. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. When an incident hits, who responds? The firefighters, EMTs, and the paramedics. And any information that we have beforehand is very important. We've learned that a long time ago. We're trying to break this barrier of intelligence sharing. And I think the FDNY has been working with Homeland Security, And in our new operations center, which we're very proud of, we have a $17 million operations center. I invite you, Billy, next time you're in the city to come.
I'd love to.
And it's, we're very proud of it. As I told you before, on September 11th, I was banged up a little bit, went back to our operations center. It was no more than a 15 by 10 room with some computers and some phones. Now we have almost 8,000 square foot of all the latest technology. We have a secure room where we have a Homeland Security website that we're on. We have a secure phone, secure fax. Something happens here in Washington, we're sharing information with them. And we need to get this out for the rest of the fire service. We need everybody in the fire service to have the same capabilities that we have.
Communicating with their local, state,
with local, state, federal resources. We have to get the information from law enforcement quicker.
Now, is your what's the title for the operations center?
It's Fire Department Operations,
FDOC. That's what FDOC. I was trying to think of. Okay, the FDOC is staffed around the clock?
Staffed around the clock. We have two fire officers. And
which is not a communication center. This is separate from your fire communication center.
This is definitely not communications.
Yeah.
This is how we monitor what's going on throughout the city. So we have two fire officers and four firefighters 24/7. And they're monitoring every incident throughout the city. If we have a special event, we beef that up. If we have a major event, we even send more people into it. But it has six people around the clock every day, 24/7.
Wow.
So that if something is going on, I mean, I have to know if there's an event in Manhattan. When you're dealing with terrorists, you have to think like a terrorist.
Right.
There's something else going on that maybe this is a diversion. And I know it's a crazy way to, but this new world we operate in, the world of terrorism preparedness. But
that's what your FDOC people are doing. They're trying to think ahead. Okay,
absolutely.
What could else happen?
Right. They need to tell me what's going on throughout the
city. That's your experts.
That's
then.
It.
Wow.
Yeah. In September, we're having a fire department intelligence enterprise where we're bringing 16 chief of departments from throughout the country for a two-day meeting.
Wow.
With Homeland Security, FBI, to see how we can perpetuate this project that we have going on in New York City. This isn't only a city project. This is a total country project. We're very excited about it. We're getting a good response.
Excellent.
It's going to be a two-day seminar so that we can take this information that we are sharing with Homeland Security and getting it throughout the country. We're very excited about that. I think that's something that the fire service has been shut out for a long time. A long time.
Well, that's great to see the CFDNY take the lead, too. When I was growing up in Long Island, it almost seems like there was a wall around the city. And now you really, I mean, just by you being here, as I mentioned earlier, and putting seminars together, the Burns Center was doing seminars for years and bringing people in. So it's really neat to see you sharing the experiences with the job's learning with the rest of us out here, too.
Since I've been in a position, I've told the members of the department that anything that we do in New York City is not just for New York City. It's for the fire service. Any developments that we develop, we're developing an electronic command board that as soon as we can get this thing developed, we want to share it with the rest of the country and the world.
Which is going to replace the board you're currently
using. It's going to replace our old-fashioned boards that you just put metal
magnets
and crayon and chalk. And it's just, we need to get ahead of where we were. And anything that we develop is not only for us, it's for the fire service. And we're willing to share it with anybody because we don't have the moat down. You know, this isn't a castle where we're impervious to anything else. We know that we're vulnerable just like anybody else. As big as we are, we're probably more vulnerable than anybody else.
Sure, right.
So that's why we are on this fast track to develop new equipment, new technologies, new procedures, new information sharing. And like I say, this conference in September is just to let the rest of the country know that we're all in this together. If we act as a service together, we're going to be all safer. And again, I come to work every day with one mission, to make sure that all my firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics go home the way they came, safe.
Sets the example. You know, as a fire chief, be it my chief of department with our 70 members or you with your 14,000 members, I remember an instructor years ago, and I mentioned this on the show I did last week, who told me that the company officer is where the rubber meets the road. A great chief can have all the great ideas in the world, but that company officer is the one that's got to make it happen or not happen, whether you want your people to wear their seatbelts, wear their masks, you know, slow down and not blow through red lights and stuff like that. What's FDNY doing to enhance the officer training? You've changed probie school, you've enhanced that, and I know you've done a lot for fire officers, and I had actually Last week we had Chief Richie Blattis on.
Sure.
And he up in the Bronx, and he shared some of the things. But from your perspective, currently what's going on as far as training your officers, and what would you like to see for the future?
Well, what we do is when a firefighter gets promoted to lieutenant, they go to 5 weeks of school. And that's constantly been increased. When I got promoted to lieutenant, I had one day. And then I was out there. I was the boss.
Wow.
One day I was sitting in the back seat. The next day I was sitting in the front seat. And it's not fair to the firefighter that's being promoted. It's not fair to the firefighters that work with them. It's not fair to the public. Right now we have, when a person gets promoted to lieutenant, they get 5 weeks of schooling. Classroom, hands-on, how to be the boss. You're absolutely correct when you say the company officers is the linchpin. They are the people in the field that deal with the firefighters every day. I can send out thousands of directives. If they're not carried out, they don't mean anything.
That's right.
I can give you the best equipment in the world. If it's not worn, it doesn't mean anything. I can give you the best apparatus in the world. If you don't put your seatbelt on, it doesn't mean anything.
That's right.
So the company officer and the chief officer are unbelievably important. So we train our lieutenants. We give them 5 weeks of schooling before we put them out into the field. It's a very intensive program. It's done at our fire academy. They get, like I said, they get classroom work. They get experience on how to talk in front of an audience. They get communication skills. And we keep expanding that every couple of years. And I'm getting buy-in from the city, and that training is very important. They haven't given me a lot of pushback on expanding. Once you get promoted to captain, we send you to school for 3 weeks.
Now, Chief, before you go further, your lieutenants have to have some college?
Yes, they have to have 60 college credits right now.
Captains?
Captains have to have 80.
Battalion chief?
Battalion chief's going to have a degree.
A bachelor's degree?
Bachelor's degree, and a deputy's going to have a bachelor's degree. The new test, both of them have to have a bachelor's degree.
Okay, go ahead back. I wanted our audience to know that we're not just talking about guys that don't already had some high level of education. Before you think about becoming an officer, you need to have some college.
Without a doubt. And it's extremely important. Again, this is not just a blue-collar job.
Sure.
To be an officer, you have to have a lot of different skills. You have to have communication skills. You have to have knowledge of many different subjects. And, you know, college helps that.
So now we're going with a lieutenant who's a shift tour commander to the captain who is the supreme commander of that company, at work or not. Captain, this is your company.
Sure.
So what are you doing with the captains?
Well, captain, now they come in, and we never had a captain's course before. And when I was chief operations, we got approached, and I thought it was very important that we were able to get a week's training out of them. And after the first round of captain's training, the instructor, the chief of training, came to me and says, it's a great course. He says, but it's not enough. I said, well, we never had it before. He says, yeah, now that we started doing it, we realized that it's a lot more important. And I said, okay, come back and see how much you really need. They came back with a three-week course. I was able to sell a three-week course, and now the captains get three additional weeks of training when they get promoted to captain. You know, how to be a leader of the company, sure. How do you instill the pride, along with all the fire scenarios that
and
you have
to
do.
How do you supervise three lieutenants?
How do you supervise three lieutenants, 25 firefighters when you're not there?
That's right.
You know, very difficult skills. So then when you get promoted to captain, you get those three additional weeks of training. Now when you get promoted to chief, battalion chief, this is another course that really has been growing exponentially. When I got promoted to battalion chief, I got 2 days of training. So they really were big then. I got one as a lieutenant, two as a battalion chief.
Wow.
And you're out in the field.
Yeah.
And now you want to talk about an eye-opener. You're going from commanding a company to commanding 6-7 units. A real, real eye-opener. Our command course now, what we call it, is 6 weeks of training. And I'm talking about very intensive training.
That's for the new battalion chief.
New battalion chief. They get different types of fire scenarios, along with all their personnel issues. Sure. But the fire scenarios are the lifeblood of the our command course. Again, the instructors are all chief officers that have had time in the field. And they get a tremendous amount of training in that 6 week period. After they get the training, we let them go mentor with a battalion chief for a couple of tours before we send them out. So we're doing mentoring also. And it's a great, great program. And when they come out of there, they're very well schooled. They're very well versed in what a battalion chief needs to do. And then they go out into the field. When you get to be promoted to a deputy chief, we don't have a deputy's course. But again, we have 50 deputy chiefs in the city. Most of them were promoted in the last 4 or 5 years.
So they've had that training.
They've had some of the command course training, but we I got a lot of feedback from my staff to say that, look, we have young deputies, they need to have a training course. So we have a one-week course that was just developed, and in September, all deputy chiefs are going to go to a one-week school.
So it'll probably end up like the others, though. You'll build
exactly.
On that.
Exactly, yeah. Interesting. If I have one wish, it'll be that I can expand on all these schools in the very near future,
okay.
All these classes that we give to our promotees and our probies.
People just don't realize.
Tremendous amount of training.
Especially the education side, yeah.
Dangerous job, very dangerous job, and, you know, one miss and you can get extremely, you can get killed or you can get very
sure. And then the responsibility of being for those
yep.
people. Let's tie that into, as we start winding down the show, Chief, because I know the schedule's tight today, and I'd love to have you back again.
Sure.
Actually, maybe what we could do is after you have that terrorism summit, maybe you can share some of that.
Love to come on and do it.
So we can share that with the folks out there. As a longtime fire chief in New York City, I know even in my capacity, there are certain line-of-duty deaths that come to mind that I've learned from that I'll never forget. I mean, we say we'll never forget any of them, but certainly some really stick in our heads. Father's Day fire is one that I knew some folks involved in that. And how ironic that occurred right prior, you know, a few months just before 9/11. But I also remember, as a young firefighter, when I was growing up, the firefighter in the Bronx when the rope broke,
Fitzpatrick.
That's
sure.
right.
Yeah.
And that whole situation and ropes and all. How about you? You got a long history in this department. What are some of the line duty deaths that you have in mind? Personally, professionally, and what are some of the things you've done to try and make sure those don't happen to somebody else?
Well, every line of duty death is one you don't forget. So it's I would never pick out one to say it's more important
sure.
than the other. But like you mentioned the rope incident up in the Bronx, and when we lost two firefighters there, that changed the whole face of the department as far as because of that rope issue, we ended up with a safety battalion, which we never had before. And the safety battalion is extremely important. We have a great chief of safety right now, Al Hay. You know Al. And
Al's very active with us at the IFC as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. And you know,
he's out there.
We're trying to develop this whole safety culture change in the department. And Al is leading the way along with myself and Chief Papagallo.
He's got the right demeanor for it.
Without
it's
a doubt.
A tough,
it's a tough job.
You're trying to change culture.
So, you know, that changed the face of the department by allowing us to have a safety battalion. But again, naturally, the Father's Day fire is interesting in that we lost three firefighters that day, and you know there's a lot of inspectional issues with people having illegal storage, and that actually borne a local law now that any of those basement areas have to be sprinkled. So that was a very historic fire.
They weren't lost in vain.
They weren't lost in vain.
Something's changed since that death, and that says
if
a lot.
Something changed. A lot of things have changed in that we. People more keen to inspectional issues, and when you can get a local law passed because of a fire death, at least something good has come out
yes.
of it. So, you know, that was another death, and, you know, naturally, we lost two people up in the Bronx last August 27th, and then we had a terrible fire in January of 05 where we had to have six firefighters jump out a window.
Sure.
Both of those were attributed to a faulty construction. And that's born a lot of our training out of that, out of the Bronx fire. And everybody carries a personal safety system now.
Right.
We got ropes back into the field, which we've been trying to get for a long time, but it took a terrible tragedy. We lost two firefighters and four others were seriously injured.
Sure.
So, you know, that fire sticks out in my mind. You know, being the chief of operations at the time, it was a terrible event. And, you know, talking to the families,
sure.
It was very hard on the whole department. But again, something good came out of it. Every firefighter in New York City, every officer and every battalion chief is carrying a rope now. So if the same thing happens, we can prevent that.
Have a better chance.
So that was another one that sticks out of my mind. And naturally, September 11th, when I lost all my closest friend and people that I've met throughout the job and my mentor, Bill Feehan, you know, we'll never forget that day. And we shouldn't forget that day because that day will keep us going to train. And prepare for
keeps
any event.
Keeps the coach going.
Absolutely. It makes me keep going. It makes me keep ticking.
Sure. You've got a great relationship with us. I'm on the, as you know, the board of directors of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. And you've developed a wonderful relationship with us and our director, Ron Sarnicky.
Yeah.
And you're developing actually an in-house program There's the National Courage to Be Safe program, and you're working on something within the organization too to try and push the culture change within too.
I think the you know, Ron's become a very good friend of mine.
He's great.
Like early October of 2001, had a meeting with Ron and Malachi Corrigan was our counseling unit.
Sure.
And we sat down. He says, "What can we do for you?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Whatever you need, we're here for you." And they provide a tremendous amount of counseling for us and help us expand our counseling unit. And, you know, that perpetuates. We have done so much with counseling that we're in Charleston right now helping them.
Right.
And it's a great way for my department to pay back what people did for us after September 11th. And we had so much help to get through this. We didn't get through it alone. We had a lot of help throughout the country and the world. So that's a way for us to pay back. But dealing with the National Forum Fighters Foundation and the Everyone Goes Home program, we are changing, not trying, we are changing the safety culture of this department. We have just made a video along with the Whistle Stop Tour. It's not even finished yet. The foundation came up, sent a lot of people up. We had all of our chiefs. We've had fire officers that have been burnt. We had a widow come on the show.
Beautiful.
We had a mother of a young firefighter, Tommy Brick, that we lost.
Sure.
So Mrs. Brick came on, and she says to me, "Is this a good thing?" I says, "No, it's not a good thing. It's a great thing. If somebody hears you say how your son's death has affected not only you and your husband, but his sister and the children,
whole family.
The whole family. If they hear it from you, it's going to ring home. Hearing it from somebody that they don't know is not going to have the same impact." So we've used all our own people on this video. And when we get this video out into the field, it's going to be really, really powerful. Then they're not only going to hear from me, they're going to hear from their co-workers, their peers.
Sure.
People that they've gone to the funerals for, they're going to hear from a widow. Tara Stackpole is a tremendous representative for this department.
Yeah.
She's going to talk about how Timmy's death affected her whole family. And I think if we can get that message home, this whole change that we're going to do is going to make it a lot easier. And if we can do it in New York,
that's right,
with almost 15,000 members, every fire department can do it. There's no saying, "Well, I can't do it, it's tradition." Forget it. Our job is to make sure everybody goes home.
If we love being firefighters, why wouldn't we want to keep doing it as long as we can?
That's correct.
It's simple. Well, Chief, any final word for our listeners before we head to the exhibit floor and wander around and buy things we probably don't need?
I just feel like I'm, you know, I know Lou Gehrig always made this statement, he was the luckiest man alive. I feel like I am the luckiest man alive to be the chief of the greatest fire department in the world, leading the greatest people in the world. But not only that, being part of the fire service, that's one big family. And realizing that working together, the fire service can overcome any hurdle that comes in its way. And, you know, as long as I'm the chief, I'm going to try to make that happen.
Well, spoken like a good coach. And we're lucky to have you here and your attitude. And as you said today, not just you, your staff chiefs, your deputies, your battalions, all reaching out, all opening up that department, sharing the information back and forth. It really is a different department.
Yes.
And that's a good thing in light of the tragedy you went through. So thanks for being with us this week. Again, Chief Sal Cassano, Chief of Department, FDNY. This is Through the Smoke. We're live at Baltimore at Firehouse Expo. Although the show will be broadcast a few weeks later, it was good to see so many of you at the show. What a turnout. Unbelievable. Thanks to Dennis Smith at First Responder Financial for his hosting of the show. And everyone, take care of yourselves. My name is Billy Goldfeder. This is radio at firehouse.com. Take care.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.